This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Patriot Act, national security versus personal privacy. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A rare coalition of liberals and conservatives may hold up reauthorization of the Patriot Act before Congress adjourns for the holidays. When the FBI failed to prevent September 11th, Congress enacted what supporters call vital new intelligence tools for preventing terrorism. But opponents say the Patriot Act allows unchecked intrusion by federal agents into the private affairs of innocent Americans. On To the Point, we'll hear about library records, sneak and peek searches, and national security letters. On Reporter's Notebook later on, assassination and government stability in Lebanon. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Gun groups, tax watchdogs, and other conservative organizations have allied with the American Civil Liberties Union to delay reauthorization of the Patriot Act before Congress leaves Washington for the holidays. On To the Point, our national security letters, a bigger threat to privacy than library searches. Will the Senate see a bipartisan filibuster? On Reporter's Notebook, a massive street protest today in Beirut. We'll hear what the latest assassination could mean for Lebanon's government. First, this news update. President Bush has delivered the last in a series of four speeches designed to regenerate support for the war in Iraq before tomorrow's election. At the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, he made a surprising concession.
And it is true that much of the intelligence turned out to be wrong. As president, I'm responsible for the decision to go into Iraq. And I'm also responsible for fixing what went wrong by reforming our intelligence capabilities. And we're doing just that.
Unlike Monday's appearance in Philadelphia, today's event did not include questions and answers. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, always good to have you on our program.
Warren, great to be with you.
Was there, other than this concession about intelligence, was there anything particularly new in what the president said today?
Well, this was a sort of a greatest hits of his major addresses on Iraq, and so there wasn't a whole lot that was new in itself. But it was remarkable not only that he admitted this mistake, but that he devoted a good proportion of the early part of that speech to remaking the case for war in Iraq. You would think that at the end of this extensive speechifying process, he'd have moved on from there and concentrated on the elections, which have already begun. In fact, we're still back where we were 2002, 2003, and all the time since, re-arguing why we went to war.
Is there any explanation from the White House as to why that point was made at this particular point, in terms of the strategy involved?
They say that they have to keep making these cases because, most notably because the Democrats have been arguing unfairly, according to the White House, that the president misled the country to go to war, and so they need to keep repeating their rebuttal, as it were, and this is a White House that sees a virtue in being repetitive.
Richard Wolff, again with Newsweek magazine. Even before the president spoke, Senate Democrats accused him of not saying anything new, and here's Minority Leader Harry Reid.
He continues to say, stay the course. He continues to say, we're winning. But based on his three speeches, if this were a baseball game, he would already be struck out.
Again, the minority leader, Harry Reid, nothing much new in what he said there in that soundbite, but Carl Levin from Michigan made another point along with Reid, which was that the president ought to address himself to the Iraqis and the issue of changing the Constitution as soon as the new parliament is elected. You mentioned, though, that the president said nothing about the election itself, much less what would happen afterwards.
Right, and Senator Levin made the important point here that everyone's talking about the elections, but that basically the political process in Iraq deferred the hard work of the Constitution till after the election. And you know, the president made some assertions about the power of democracy in Iraq, among them that democracy would stop terrorism, but also that democracy would lead to a better future, that there has been substantial political progress on the ground in Iraq. And while there has been progress, Senator Levin is right. There hasn't been this kind of national compact where Sunni and Shia have come together to unite and form a national politics.
We'll be talking about that on our To the Point program tomorrow. Meantime, Richard Wolff, what is the White House saying about the results of the president's campaign? Very conspicuous, labeled as a public relations campaign, four speeches in a row, all leading up to the election. Do they think that it's worked?
They do, but they are also realistic. They don't think it's going to show up in the polls anytime soon. They see this as more of a process that will go through the State of the Union and maybe start showing up in terms of public polling by February, March time. So they take they're not naive about how long this decline has been in terms of public support or how quickly they can turn it around. They are pleased that the shift in tone has been widely spread and reported on by the media. So they see it as being positive, but by no means the sort of end of the story for them.
How are relations with Congress, as Congress is about to adjourn? It seems to that there's not going to be much of the president's agenda enacted before the end of the year.
Well, to say it's not easy would be an understatement. Relationships, obviously, with Democrats are tough, and you would expect that, but the unexpected story of this year has been this gradual deterioration of the relationship between the White House and senior Republicans, the congressional leadership, and there has been expressed repeated frustration most recently, a week or two ago, between congressional leaders and the White House saying you're not doing a good enough job, especially on Iraq, but also on the economy. That's in terms of the performance, but also getting the message out.
So we'll be hearing from the president, presumably then, on those subjects between now and when Congress comes back.
We're heading into downtime for the president, party season, and some reflection, not least about changes, possible changes to his cabinet and also to his senior White House staff. But certainly in the new year, with the run-up to the State of the Union and that major address itself, yes, Iraq, the economy, and some domestic agenda.
Okay.
As well.
We'll be looking for those changes in the staff and the cabinet as well. Richard Wolff, again, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. Anytime.
In a moment, the Patriot Act. Is it national security versus personal privacy? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. Since enactment of the Patriot Act after September 11th, there's been bitter controversy over provisions allowing searches of library records and secret searches of homes and businesses. Now, as Congress debates the reenactment of parts of the act, one critic calls that debate a gift for the Justice Department. The Los Angeles Times reports that a more intrusive practice has been overlooked in public discussions. That's the so-called National Security Letter. Richard Schmidt wrote the story, and Richard, thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Warren?
Good. What's the National Security Letter? It antedates the Patriot Act, does it not?
It does. It was enacted way back in the 80s, that's a fact that that Republicans hasten to point out in this debate that it wasn't by itself a creature of the Patriot Act, but in fact there is a provision in the Patriot Act that has basically facilitated the use of these national security letters, which is basically a kind of administrative subpoena that like an FBI agent or senior FBI agent can basically issue on his own authority as opposed to going to a court.
What are some of the other provisions that are being objected to, or the other aspects of not just the national security letter, but the way it's being used?
Of national security letters, I think they're used to obtain so-called transactional information about phone and internet records and financial information, that sort of thing. And it's remained a fairly a practice that's of a concern of a lot of folks, but the scale in which it's been used has sort of been a secret. There was a recent Washington Post story that indicated that these things are being used to the tune of like 30,000 of them every year since 9/11, which has sort of helped reshape the debate here at the last hour in the whole debate about the Patriot Act.
And my understanding is that part of the concern is that the people involved, the people whose transactions can be looked into with a national security letter, are not necessarily suspected of terrorism, but rather they might be associated in some way that they don't even know about.
That's right, and that's you've put your finger on really a key issue in this whole debate surrounding not just national security letters, but other kinds of records gathering authorities that are in the Patriot Act, and that is, what does the government have to prove? You know, can they obtain information, and can they seek out information that's merely sort of related to a terrorist investigation, or do they have to prove a higher degree of connectiveness? You know, do they have to prove to a court that they have a suspicion that you know the persons whose records they're trying to obtain is really somehow related to a suspected terrorist, or maybe a suspected terrorist, in fact.
You talked about the scale of use, and there was a report in the Washington Post, as you indicated, that there might be 30,000 of these going out every year. What has the Justice Department said about that?
Well, they said that's erroneous. At the same time, they say it's the true number is classified, and they've declined to identify the number of letters that have been sent out. I think among experts that I've talked to, they believe the number is pretty significant. Whether or not it's 30,000 or 10,000 or whatever, it certainly towers over the number of times that the government has used the better-known so-called library provision, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which perhaps has been used just a few dozen times since 9/11.
And the other thing about the national security letter is that you're not supposed to tell anybody that you have one, have received one.
That's right. And these letters, they typically go to internet service providers or banks or those sorts of things. You know, so if you're being a customer in the bank, you're probably not really going to know about it. But and the concern is that the recipient has little incentive to challenge the letter in court. You know, that they want to maintain relations with law enforcement authorities, and it's not their records, you know, and so there's concern that there's no real vested interest in any event. Although there is a case that the ACLU has pursued in Connecticut on behalf of a person who has helped control and organize digital records of libraries up in Connecticut, and he's challenging in court in a proceeding that's largely under seal this authority to sort of gag him from talking about the circumstances.
My understanding is that the House today has passed the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which means that the so-called sunset clauses, as I understand it now, by a compromise, will still be sunsetted for 4 years from now, rather than 10 years, as the administration had originally asked. Is this issue of the national security letters part of that, or is that separate from the argument about which clauses should be sunsetted and for how long?
Well, some Democrats and opponents of this the conference report had sought to get some kind of a sunset provision affecting national security letters, but they are unsuccessful in doing that. There are basically two sections of the Patriot Act and a related section that are going to be sunset if the conference report is embraced by the Senate as well. But you're right; just moments ago, in fact, the House by about 251 to 174 approved this conference report. Interestingly enough, it's a closer call than it was back after 9/11 when the original Patriot Act was approved by Congress, and it was, you know, virtually overwhelming. I think something on the order of 350, the vote was like 357 to 98 in approval of the Patriot Act. And in the Senate, you only had one one person, Senator Feingold, you know, opposed to the Patriot Act. So we have as time has worn on here and the debate has become more full and developed, you know, people have developed concerns about how the Patriot Act's operated in practice.
And there's talk about even this compromise being filibustered by the Senate, by a bipartisan coalition. We'll talk about that a bit later. Richard Schmidt, once again, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering the Justice Department, listening carefully to our conversation. An important representative of that department, Will Mishalla, is Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren, for having me.
What about this? The FBI agent can demand access to telephone records, financial transactions, website visits, not because people are suspects, but because the information is somehow relevant to an investigation. What does relevant mean?
Well, relevant is a standard that is well established in the law, and it's important to remember that national security letters, Rick had mentioned that they'd been around since the mid-80s. Actually, some of them have been around since the 70s, One was enacted in 1986 and sponsored then by Senator Patrick Leahy. Relevance
is Patrick Leahy, an advocate of civil liberties and personal privacy in the Senate. Go ahead.
And a senior member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Relevance is a widely recognized standard in law enforcement, and the point here is that these NSLs can only be used for international terrorism and espionage cases. They cannot be used, for example, to investigate domestic terrorism. So an NSL could not be used to investigate Timothy McVeigh, for example, or Eric Rudolph. These are very limited with regard to the scope of the sorts of documents that could be obtained and with regard to the institutions that they would go to. I would point out that of the 9/11 Commission recently came out with a scorecard, and many of the scores were pretty low. However, one score was the highest grade they gave to the government was an A- on terror financing, and national security letters are critical in tracking the money that terrorists may try to funnel through various institutions.
Will Mischella, Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs. All that having been said, not good enough for the ACLU. Carolyn Fredrickson is Director of the ACLU's Legislative Office in Washington. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
What are your concerns, especially with the 9/11 Commission scorecard we just heard about and the limitation of these national security letters to international terrorism and espionage cases? What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that the main problem here is that for all that Will is saying, it comes back to the standard that you had discussed earlier, the relevance standard. I'd like to mention in that Washington Post story that went into depth on the use of national security letters, there was a quote that said, "The FBI's test for relevance is so basic, it's hard to come up with a plausible way to fail." I think that is really troubling. We would like to see, along with a diverse group of senators like Senator Craig to Senator Feingold, all across the political spectrum.
Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, very conservative senator.
Very conservative, as well as a huge array of allies from the Chamber of Commerce to the American Conservative Union. These are groups and members of Congress who believe that the FBI should have to show that there's some connection to a terrorist or terrorist organization when they're
Why should they have to? What's at stake here? What's the injury potentially to somebody if they don't do that?
Well, you know, basically this whole debate is about police powers. And in our Constitution, we grant certain powers to the government and we keep certain powers for the people. And we are very insistent that government not overstep its bounds because we are concerned about people's privacy. We're concerned about abuse. The fact of the matter is that the national security letter provision was expanded by the Patriot Act to a wide array of new types of documents, including bank records, credit cards, insurance company, car dealerships, jewelry stores, hotels, casinos, travel agencies, real estate closing firms, internet service providers, which can include organizations like libraries that may provide internet access on site. That is really very broad. So it's a broad array of documents. There's no requirement that a connection be shown, that any of these records have a connection to a terrorist or a terrorist organization. And beyond that, there is no check on the FBI because there is no court oversight before these things go out. So
All
this
right.
is on the signature of an FBI official.
Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU. Back to Will Mischella, the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs. If people can't reveal when they get these letters, and if you won't comment on whether there are 30,000 a year or some lesser number, how can people know the extent to which these letters are being used, particularly when there's no judicial oversight?
Well, their elected representatives certainly know, and on a semi-annual basis, twice a year, we send classified reports to Capitol Hill.
Why classify the number? Why not say whether there are 30,000 or 25,000 or however many there are?
Well, we want to make sure that we are very careful. The folks who are going to really be interested in these numbers are going to be foreign powers and terrorist organizations. We think that it's sufficient to let the elected representatives of the people know these numbers, and we do that according to the law. I would point out, however, that the Congress, at least in this conference, has made the judgment that the aggregate number of NSLs should be disclosed, and should the conference report pass, obviously we will comply with the law fully.
All right. That conference report, the one just voted on by the House and now facing possibly a filibuster in the Senate. Back to Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU. Isn't it important to classify this information for the reasons Will Mishalla gave?
Well, I actually think to the contrary. I think it's the right of the American people to know how extensive these powers are, and the fact that they can't even be told the numbers, and that it can't be told what type of national security letter is being issued, whether it's seeking financial records or whether it's seeking internet records. I think that's pretty troubling because I think.
Are you supportive then of the conference report?
We think there should be broader disclosure. We don't think that it should be classified that the number of national security letters issued.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, as Will said, that's efficient, but that's not really the standard that we'd like to hold our government to.
So what standard should there be?
I think protection of our basic constitutional rights is something we would insist on. As I go back to the Constitution, you know, in the Fourth Amendment, we have the protection from unreasonable search and seizure. That is a very basic right, and I think most Americans understand that they have the right to be secure in their homes and in their businesses from searches that have no connection, no stated connection, certainly, to a terrorist.
All right, back to Will Mishalla. Is there something about the threat of terrorism, is there something about this 21st century threat, as it's often referred to, that's different and consequently requires some sort of modification of our expectations as far as privacy is concerned?
We believe that the government and the Justice Department and the FBI in particular do and need to stay within the confines of the Constitution. If we thought these tools were unconstitutional, we certainly wouldn't support them. With regard to the issue that that Caroline raises, which is that there isn't a specific linkage to a target, let me say this. In criminal investigation after criminal investigation, for example, if we were investigating a mobster and he happened to have financial transactions with a pizza parlor, with some other organization, prosecutors would track down those leads, oftentimes to rule out people as being complicit with the illegal activity, particularly in complex money laundering cases where you have to track the money, and then people are actually ruled out as opposed to having to use more intrusive means to determine whether or not they're involved. With regard to the issue about disclosure, Caroline is probably then opposed to the Bank Secrecy Act, which says that banks in criminal investigations can't disclose the fact that they've received a criminal law subpoena. So this is pretty common. In this area, we only wanted intelligence investigators investigating terrorism and espionage to have the exact same tools that are used by criminal investigators.
All right. Will Mishalla, Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back in a moment, give Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU an opportunity to respond to those two points about disclosure and the need to rule out certain suspects. Then we'll continue this conversation with a couple of other guests on Reporter's Notebook, Assassination and Government Stability in Lebanon. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the Patriot Act, originally enacted after September 11th to give the FBI new powers to try to prevent something like that from happening again, increasing its intelligence authority. Passed almost unanimously at that point, the reauthorization, which took place today in the House, passed by 251 to 174, a very different outcome. And it faces a possible filibuster in the Senate from a bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats. So right now on the air, we have Carolyn Fredrickson, the director of the ACLU's legislative office in Washington. Wilma Schella of the Department of Justice has just left us. But let me give you an opportunity to respond to two points that he made. First, that the national security letter is often used to gain evidence that will rule out somebody as a possible terrorist suspect, suggesting that it works then to the advantage of that person. Secondly, he mentioned that with regard to a disclosure, what do you feel about the Bank Secrecy Act, which says you can't disclose criminal subpoenas, suggesting there's a contradiction there? Go ahead.
Well, I think neither of those points are terribly valid. On the first issue, in terms of the disclosure, actually, the fact that people don't know that their records are being examined by the FBI is actually better for them. I don't want to say it's laughable, but you know, just imagine. As the Washington Post reported, there is an estimate that the FBI uses 30,000 national security letters a year, and each of those letters could gather numerous records from a variety of people. I don't know how many records that is overall, how many people are affected. All those records are gathered by the FBI, examined, and in fact kept. So I don't think most Americans would feel very comfortable with the fact that, having been engaged in lawful activity, their records have been gathered by the FBI and put in a database. People have some things that they want to keep private. On your second point, in terms of the Bank Secrecy Act, I think, you know, that when the administration tries to compare everything that's done under the Patriot Act with things that go on in criminal investigations, particularly with the gag, when there's a gag associated with a criminal investigation, that is for a finite period of time. As that criminal case is going forward. In this case, we're talking about somebody, an innocent, say it's an internet service provider, receives a national security letter requiring that company to turn over all of the internet records of their customers. The gag that accompanies that not only continues forever, but if it's violated, could result in criminal penalties for the internet service provider. That is a wholly different situation from a finite secrecy order that in an ongoing criminal investigation, which eventually will be wrapped up where there is more due process available for people to contest the appropriateness of any type of a secrecy order.
Again, Carolyn Fredrickson is director of the ACLU's legislative office in Washington. Earlier, I asked the question of Will Moshella of the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs, if there is something about terrorism that's new and different, that it's a 21st century problem and that we are using 20th century legal instruments. I got that idea from a column written by Frank Gaffney, our next guest. He's president and founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington and a columnist for the Washington Times, author of a new book called War Footing, 10 Steps America Must Take to Prevail in the War for the Free World. Frank Gaffney, good to have you back on our program.
Warren, it's great to be back with you.
What about that in the context of this conversation? You haven't heard it all. You certainly know the elements of it. We've been talking about the national security letters, and you just heard what Carolyn Fredrickson said about how uncomfortable Americans would be to know that the government is keeping permanently records of their financial transactions, their internet behavior, and so on, even though they're not suspected of anything.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't hear all of the previous exchanges. I would just say that sounds absolutely right in peacetime. But we're not in peacetime. And I think, frankly, most of our friends who are caviling about the Patriot Act and other issues that arise in its debate choose really to either ignore or at least dismiss the implications for a free society of people who are determined to destroy us, including that free society, especially those who have proven adept at exploiting our civil liberties to advance that purpose. The Patriot Act, particularly as it has now been watered down a bit, I think is a very modest intrusion on our civil liberties, Law-abiding citizens, I think most especially, have very little to worry about from this act. But what worries me, Warren, is if this act and its implementation fails, most especially if we see it expire at the end of this year, thanks to a filibuster, my very profound concern is this war will come again to our shores with a vengeance. And at that time, what you will assuredly see is the concerns of the American Civil Liberties Union and a lot of other people, including myself, about a pell-mell rush to suspend civil liberties in the interest of trying to protect our security, becoming a popular demand because of the suffering and losses that will have been entailed. So I hope the Patriot Act will continue to be the law of the land, maybe be strengthened in places, but certainly not be weakened, let alone jettisoned, lest we find ourselves facing a real crisis of civil liberties in the wake of a terrible attack that damages national security and probably cost a lot of lives.
Frank Gaffney, again, the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. You mentioned friends. Michael Osterlink is our next guest, and he is one of the founders of a group called the Liberty Coalition, which includes not only the American Civil Liberties Union, but, Michael Osterlink, a lot of other organizations that are on the very conservative side of the political spectrum in the United States. First, thanks for being with us. Second, tell us what some of those groups are.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that. We actually have 34 groups across the political spectrum, including Gun Owners of America, Americans for Tax Reform, American Conservative Union, and other conservative and libertarian groups, as well as groups on the left side of the political spectrum.
Well, what do they, what do you say to what Frank Gaffney just said, that if we don't suspend or intrude in a what he refers to as a modest way on civil liberties, it's going to be even worse?
Well, I speak only for the Liberty Coalition itself, not for any of our partner groups. But Mr. Gaffney talked about the difference between peacetime and wartime. And I think that distinction is dangerous because this is an undeclared endless war, which means we will never have, quote-unquote, peacetime in our time because we have no specific enemy that we're fighting, no end date in mind, and the administration has acknowledged over time that this is a war that's going to continue on indefinitely into the future because it's going to be an impossibility to kill all terrorists.
What about the argument, though, that if the terrorists are successful in some way, there will be demands from the American people to fully suspend or at least more completely suspend, and not just intrude on, civil liberties?
Well, actually, I would agree with Mr. Gaffney on that point. Unfortunately, the American people, to some degree, have become what I would refer to as sheeple, and they too quickly fall underneath the sway and reticence of the federal government and the national security state that we've been building for the past couple of decades. And as a result of that, anytime there is or will be in the future an emergency inside this country, I'm afraid that the first response of the American people in general will be to ask the federal government to, quote-unquote, provide them with security at the expense of our liberties. So in that case, I do agree with Mr. Gaffney.
Michael Osterlink with the Liberty Coalition. Back to Frank Gaffney, Center for Security Policy. What do you say to this? An endless war, undeclared but endless, so that whatever intrusion there is isn't going to stop.
Well, Warren, in this book you've mentioned, War Footing, we do describe this as a war for the free world, which is different than it's been characterized to this point, I think, by our elected leaders. I would personally prefer, and called for it at the time, a declaration of war. We describe in the book with some precision who we think the enemy is. It is first and foremost at the moment an ideology, a political totalitarian ideology, I call it Islamofascism, that is being supported and enabled by a number of state sponsors. It seems to me that the point is well taken, that we ought to be clearer about the fact that they are our enemies, unless they behave differently and cease to be, by stopping this support of terror and the fascism that that uses it as an instrument against us, and not only against us, but others in this free world. And my argument is principally this. I don't want to see this be an open-ended war any more than anybody else does. I think the way to keep that from happening, though, is to treat it as a war, to mobilize the American people to fight this war, to make it clear what the stakes are, indeed the free world itself being most precisely at stake, And in so doing, I think create conditions in which you can safely return to peacetime conditions and the full range of civil liberties we all hold dear and would like to see us get back to as quickly as possible.
In the meantime, though, it seems to me if you have to restrict civil liberties, it's a war for a less free world than it is now. Aren't you, by doing that, then conceding some victory to those that you describe as the enemy?
I don't think so. I think you're doing prudent things that enable the future survival of the free world. You know, it's been pointed out, I'm sure, earlier in the show, but, you know, when Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, it was not because in the Civil War he wanted to make the Union less free. It was he felt that it was an essential step to assuring its survival. This is what nations do in time of war. We did not seek this war. It was inflicted upon us. We cannot get out from under it without surrendering. These are steps in the Patriot Act, I think, precisely, that have to be taken at a minimum. I hope more will not be necessary, and indeed, I most especially hope we can avoid a calamitous attack that will, I think we agree, precipitate far worse intrusions on those civil liberties.
Abraham Lincoln was not, in fact, part of our earlier argument. Let me go back to Carolyn Fredrickson, director of the ACLU's legislative office in Washington. What about that? This is wartime. This is a question of national survival, comparable to what happened during the Civil War when Abraham Lincoln felt that, rightly or wrongly, he had to suspend habeas corpus.
Well, you know, I think that we actually have to be very careful about our civil liberties at war. I think what Frank had said about the possibility of people demanding more concessions later, it seems sort of perverse to me to make concessions to with our civil liberties now to prevent more later. I think the United States has actually had some of its most alarming civil liberties violations precisely during wartime. We should be doubly vigilant to ensure that we're not backing away from our Constitution and taking out certain of our fears on some of our own population. I mean, for example, the internment camps for the Japanese, the way some German Americans were treated during World War One. I think we have to be very, very cautious that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We do obviously need to protect ourselves against terrorists. None of us on the reform side of the coalition are asking that the Patriot Act not be renewed. It's a false dichotomy. There is a way to resolve this. The Senate passed a bill unanimously that adopted certain sensible protections to our civil liberties, modified the Patriot Act powers slightly, but would really advance the ability for Americans to know that terrorists are being fought, but their own privacy is being protected.
Again, Carolyn Fredrickson with the ACLU. Back to Michael Osterlink with the Liberty Coalition, again, spanning the political spectrum, coming himself from a conservative libertarian standpoint. What are some of the people on your side of this argument, the rightward side, if I can put it that way, concerned about? What are the specific abuses that organizations like the Gun Owners or the Association of Physicians and Surgeons worried about?
Well, two things. For instance, the gun owners are concerned that gun records will be captured by the FBI or other government agencies and used against gun owners in the future. Presently, they might be okay with the Bush administration, but they might be concerned with another administration down the road that is less supportive of Second Amendment rights. The physician group is concerned with medical privacy, which is foundational to the ethical practice of medicine. And medical privacy rights have been under assault for the past decade by the federal government, and Section 215 and 505, the national security letters, just continue the assault of medical privacy. And if patients don't feel confident that the information they give to their doctors is protected, then they be less likely to give that same information to their doctors, and that devalues the ability of doctors to practice good medicine.
Gun records and medical records, others that you can think of in particular that you're worried about?
Well, you know, some of the things that have been talked about over the past couple of weeks are give examples of some of the abuses. And I know in your show you've discussed that a little bit. But the problem is it's not just the potential for abuse, but the fact that we have a constitutionally limited government. Fourth Amendment to the Constitution clearly states that we have the right to be secure in our persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. So it's not whether or not they will have this power and abuse it. It's the fact that some of these powers they should not have in the first place, because it's just inappropriate for our form of government to have that type of power.
So this goes to the core of conservative thinking.
Yes. And actually, I just quickly respond to something Mr. Gaffney said. You know, our government was instituted to secure our rights, which is a very conservative principle, and is not instituted to free the world. And what our government needs to do is just be active in securing our rights, and that's about all it should be doing.
Again, Michael Osterlink with the Liberty Coalition. Back to Frank Gaffney, Center for the Security for Security Policy in Washington. What then about this Senate to compromise bill that Carolyn Fredrickson mentioned earlier? Why wouldn't you be satisfied with that, given all that we have heard specifically about the kinds of records involved, particularly medical records, and the whole conservative idea that government exists for very limited purposes, as Michael Osterlink just said?
Well, I don't want to get into a protracted philosophical debate here, but look, there are people in the libertarian community who just assume there be no government, or an exceedingly limited government, and one that is clearly inadequate, I believe, to fighting the sort of fight we have on our hands. Secondly, it has to be borne in mind, Warren, and I think you've seen evidence of this in your own community out there in Southern California.
This program comes out of Los Angeles. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have people in places like federal prisons today who are being recruited to become members of this kind of jihadist enterprise. Inside federal prisons, or in the case of New Folsom, it's a state prison. But this is happening in a society that does provide incredible civil liberties to its own citizens, and we have seen evidence that those civil liberties are being, in some cases, exploited, and I have to say, on occasion, that exploitation is being enabled by some of the people or the organizations represented on the show. The point is that it's not so much the specific provision of this bill or that bill as much as it is this idea that somehow, in time of war, we can just pretend we're not at war and we can have everything be just the way we want it in terms of the normal routine practice of civil liberties.
All right. Frank Gaffney, again, with the Center for Security Policy. Very quickly, Carolyn Fredrickson, we're almost out of time, but you're entitled to a response. Enabling exploitation of our civil liberties in the way that Frank Gaffney responded, how would you react to that statement?
Well, I, you know, frankly, don't really understand what he's talking about. If he's insinuating that the ACLU also represents people who are facing prosecution by the government because they've been accused of a crime, I think that that is an appropriate thing to do because we do have a system where people are innocent until proven guilty, and some individuals in our society don't have the wherewithal to afford a defense attorney.
Okay, Frank Gaffney, is that what you meant?
I'm talking about terrorists. I'm talking about people suspected of plotting to do violent damage to this country and its people, and not just the average criminal.
Ms. Fredrickson,
they're
quickly
entitled to due process, but we ought to be clear about their nature.
Just trying to clarify here. Ms. Fredrickson, I've got 15 seconds left. Go ahead.
Well, I think standing up for our civil liberties, which is what we're doing, and trying to ensure that the Patriot Act is reformed, is a patriotic thing to do, and the fact that people try to say we're somehow helping terrorists by doing so, I think, is doing a disservice to the American people.
All right. We have gotten a real sense of some of the issues that are being debated now in the Congress. Again, the House has reauthorized the Patriot Act. We'll see what the Senate does. And thanks all of you for helping to clarify the issues. Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU in Washington, Frank Gaffney with the Center for Security Policy, Michael Osterlink of the Liberty Coalition, and thanks to our earlier guests, Will Mischella, Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs, and Rick Schmidt of the Los Angeles Times. Tens of thousands of Lebanese have turned out on the streets of Beirut to protest the latest assassination of a major public figure. In a moment, more on the events that could topple a government in the Middle East on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Orman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. With the United Nations already investigating one assassination in Lebanon, it's now being asked to look into another. Earlier this year, it was former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. This week, it was the prominent journalist Gibran Tweni, also an elected parliamentarian and an outspoken critic of Syria. Marius Deeb is professor of Middle East History and Politics at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, author of Syria's Terrorist War on Lebanon and the Peace Process. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
How important is this second assassination in terms of the context of Lebanese politics and its relationship with Syria?
It's very important, not only for Lebanese politics and Syria, but it's important for the region, because Tueni was a publisher and a columnist, a daily columnist of Al-Nahar newspaper, which is a very important newspaper, probably is the best newspaper in the Arab world, and the freest, and therefore killing him is just trying to kill a person who represents freedom, who wants to speak the truth about Syria's tyranny and the way it has dominated Lebanon and continues to engage in terrorism against the Lebanese politicians and Lebanese people.
There was a huge public outcry after the assassination of the former Prime Minister Hariri. Why, that now has been linked to Syria by the investigation being conducted by the United Nations, why would the Syrians, presumably that they were behind this, presuming that they were behind this, why would they conduct another assassination?
Yeah, I mean, the two assassinations go very much in the tradition of Syria's use of terrorism to achieve its objectives. From the early 80s onwards, actually from even the mid-70s, one could argue, for the last 30 years. So killing any person who, like Hariri, who was crucial for winning elections in Lebanon with the opposition and ousting Syria, was important for Syria, but there was a backlash. They didn't expect that. Now killing Tueni is easier for them because they're already accused of a murder, of a terrorist operation against Hariri and others. Now killing another person to them doesn't make a difference because they've already been accused. But they want to silence a person who is outspoken, whose newspaper is read everywhere, including in Syria, because it's available on the Internet on a daily basis.
We now learned, again, tens of thousands of people have gone onto the streets in Beirut. What is the situation with regard to the government of Lebanon? Can it withstand this? It's backed, presumably, the president, Emil Lahoud, is backed by Syria.
Yes. The president himself, you know, the whole crisis started with renewal for the president in September 2004, and definitely he represents a pro-Syrian figure who should go. But also the cabinet has a group of people, around five, who are pro-Syrian, representing, unfortunately, you know, the Amal movement, which is a Shiite movement, more important, Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization. Both are pro-Syrian and up till now have not really condemned Syria, nor criticized Syria, nor blamed Syria for anything. And these should go, and there is a chance that the cabinet would either be reformed again by the prime minister, you know, kind of getting rid of some cabinet members and finding new ones, or these guys who have already suspended their membership, the five pro-Syrian cabinet members, would remain so, or perhaps they would resign.
With the assassination of Mr. Tueni, what about the voice of the opposition in Lebanon? Will there be, do you think, a squelching effect on other journalists?
Yes, I think the journalists fear most because, you know, they are, I suppose, they are the most in the limelight because you write almost daily and they have to write about certain things, and of course Syria will not approve what they're writing, and that's the real danger. They might not silence the journalists, but the journalists might become more careful in how they phrase their you know, their articles and the statements with respect to Syria. But with respect to opposition, I think on the contrary, it will reinforce the opposition, it's strengthening the opposition. And after all, if you recall the famous demonstration of 14th of March, exactly 1 month after the assassination of Hariri, it had 1.5 million Lebanese. The opposition managed to get almost 40% of the Lebanese population on the street in a peaceful, democratic, totally nonviolent demonstration. And I think they're seeking to do the same nonviolently through democratic means, and I think they could win. They are the majority. Those who support Syria are a minority.
Again, we're talking with Marius Deeb, who's professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Well, you said that the people running the government now are the Shiites, somewhat allied with Syria, and also sympathetic to Hezbollah. Who is on the other side?
Yeah, the people, they don't trust the government. They're only 5 out of, 24.
Oh.
So what you have here, you have a minority, but they're obstructing the government, in making moves, further moves towards investigating Hariri's murder. And fortunately, the government, after the assassination of Tweny, went ahead and said the UN should investigate this assassination as well as the others, and also asked for an international tribunal to a court for trying those who are responsible. And this is a very good step forward. Now, Hezbollah and Amal have only 5 members out of 24, but they are obstructive. By suspending the membership and perhaps resigning, it will give the government more freedom to move forward. The president is a problem. He's not as much a problem as Hezbollah and Amal, but he's a problem. He's been pro-Syrian, he's been obstructive, and I think he should be removed, and a new president should be elected through parliament.
Well, thank you very much. What do you think of the prospects of that, very briefly, before we need to close our program?
Yeah, the prospects are good. I mean, I don't know how long it will take, but definitely it's moving in the right direction. The outrageous act of killing such an important parliamentarian and journalist and prominent opposition leader of the Sida Revolution, I think it will push the government and the opposition further towards getting the international community in their support and getting Lebanon back to a truly democratic and free society.
Thanks again. Marius Deeb, professor at Johns Hopkins, author of Syria's Terrorist War on Lebanon and the Peace Process. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Karen Radziner, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.